Hey everyone, welcome to the Pot Awareness Podcast, and thanks for joining me. This podcast is specifically for about educating and raising awareness for animals and rescues and organizations across the United States and world. It really goes a long way towards this mission when our listeners rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and all of our other podcast platforms. Also, be sure to check us out on our official website at pawawareness.org and on social media at TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram at pawawareness_podcast. You can check us out for all of our latest bits and clips of our podcast, as well as Pet of the Week and Pet of the Month. If you're listening and involved with an animal rescue organization or have a story of your own that you want to share, reach out to us at info@pawawareness.org and we can get you on the podcast. Thanks for watching, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hey everyone, welcome to today's episode of Paw Awareness Podcast. Today I'm interviewing Lindsay Smith of Safe Haven Dog Rescue, and I'm going to go ahead and let you introduce what it is that you're doing, where are you guys located, and how long have you guys been around?
Okay, so I'm Lindsay, and I'm the owner of the rescue. We are located in Chico, California, which is about an hour and a half north of Sacramento. And I've been doing rescue for probably around 6 years, but it was in 2017 that I got the idea that I wanted to start my own rescue. And then probably 3 years ago, I actually started fully doing my own rescue.
And what was your background like before doing that? And what are some steps when you just decide, hey, I want to start my own rescue. What does that look like? How long did that take in the process there?
Okay, so my first experience with shelter dogs and rescue dogs was when I was going to Chico State. I think that I kind of had the perspective that a lot of people still have, which is that if a dog is in a shelter, it means that there's something wrong with them, whether it be like their behavior or, you know, there's a million reasons. And I realized that that's just not true. I met so many dogs that were perfect in every aspect that just were unwanted for whatever reason. This is a college town, so I think young kids getting dogs has a big role in dogs ending up in shelters here specifically. So I was volunteering at the Chico Animal Shelter, and even so with that, I wanted my own dog, but I grew up with my parents buying dogs. You know, we had like a golden retriever who I loved. So I got on the list to purchase a dog from a breeder. Luckily, the wait was like 6 months until her next litter. In that time, through Facebook, I saw a post about a dog at the Stockton Animal Shelter, which is a few hours away from me. And they were like, this dog is sweet, friendly with other dogs, friendly with people. The only thing that's wrong is he has a broken leg. So the shelter is going to euthanize him because they don't do medical care. So they couldn't just, you know, leave him to suffer with his leg. So this lady that I followed on Facebook made a post, and she was like, I just need someone to just take care of this dog until his leg heals, basically. And I was like, that sounds easy. He's probably just going to, you know, lay around and I can take care of a dog with a broken leg. So I went and picked him up, and his name is Oliver, and he's my dog, and I've had him ever since. I realized the next day that I wanted to keep him forever, and it just really opened my eyes, because I, like many people, was on a list to buy a dog, and a perfect dog that I didn't know I needed fell right into my lap. And I feel like if that happened to more people, or if more people gave that a chance, that we wouldn't have such a problem with so many dogs needing homes.
That's amazing. And I think that's, I really like the part of the story too, where you mentioned where, hey, I was on a wait list for a breeder, and then it just so happened that it didn't, you know, the wait list was long and it didn't go through.
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing, because there really are a lot of people out there who they just don't know. They just don't know that, hey, there is an opportunity cost by you being on that wait list, because while you're waiting for that dog that, you know, you're paying high money for a breeder, mm-hmm. there's another dog that's going to get put down.
Right.
And it's like, I'm never going to be like, hey, you know, I'm never going to shame someone for doing something, do what you want. But I want you people to know and have that conversation with yourself mm-hmm. and about that. So I think that's absolutely amazing mm-hmm. that's your story. What a great yeah. story. And, yeah. and what is, and currently now, what does your rescue operation look like? What are you seeing? And like, what does that look like on a day-to-day basis?
So I am a very small rescue. I am foster based, which means I don't have a facility. So I don't have a place for the dogs to go. So I can only rescue dogs if somebody offers to foster them, or more often than not, I foster them. So I usually have like 5 or 6 dogs at a time, because especially if it's a really urgent case, I don't want to wait for somebody to volunteer and I'll just take them in. But my house is small, so I have to limit myself, which was a really hard lesson because I've ended up with too many dogs before. So if somebody offers to foster a dog, I will take the dog from the shelter or whatever, like a bad situation, any situation that the dog needs help. I'll take the dog. I fully vet them. So I get them all of their vaccines. I microchip them and I get them spayed or neutered. And they wait in their foster home until somebody wants to adopt them. I have a really lengthy application because I want to make sure that these dogs are never in this situation again. So I ask a ton of questions, making sure that this potential adopter is ready for this specific dog. So it's not, I individualize the applications as well. So it's not like a standard application for each dog. It's different for each dog because I want to make sure that I'm matching the dog to the perfect owner so that they never are rehomed or end up in a shelter or come back to me again. And so far that's worked really well.
That's really cool. And I think it's really inspiring too, just for people listening and myself, where it's like, hey, I don't need a, you know, $1,000 facility or something. You're doing mm-hmm. this all out of your home. I do have a question. Mm-hmm. How does it work when you already have a couple of dogs and you have an established pack? Mm-hmm. So when you bring in one or two or however many new dogs, mm-hmm. what does that look like? Like, how do you integrate them, I guess?
So that's a complicated answer, but, so Oliver, who is my first dog, he is amazing across the board. He gets along with absolutely everyone and everything. So it's never been a problem with me bringing another dog in with him. My second dog, May, who's this white one right here, she is actually what I would consider majorly dog aggressive. And that has been a struggle for me. We've gotten into dog fights. I have to muzzle her when we walk. It has actually really helped me because I've learned so much about dog behavior, and I can safely bring in any dog, from any situation and introduce her properly to them. And there's no issue. When I bring in a new dog, I put my dogs outside. I bring in the new dog. I let him check out the house, him or her check out the house, see where they are, get comfortable. And then I crate them, and I crate them for 4 or 5 days. Obviously, I let them out to go to the bathroom and have their alone time with me. But I do not let my dogs interact with them for about 4 or 5 days. I let my dogs come up to the crate and sniff them. I let them interact between that barrier of the crate. And after a few days, when you let them out, it's kind of like, oh, we've been coexisting this whole time and it's fine. It also gives me a chance, like if they're growling at certain things, to kind of get an idea of what their behavior is, what triggers they might have, and how to avoid that. With the guy that's on the bed, his name is Kahuna. One of his triggers is resource guarding. He does not like sharing his food because he was starved. So when I got him, he was super skinny. So he's protective of his food, which does not make him a bad dog. It means that I need to feed him separately. So I do that to avoid fights. But it's just really important to give the new dog enough space to just relax and be themselves. If you introduce them too quickly, it could cause irreversible damage between the dog's relationship. So it's just really important to just take your time, basically. Take a lot of time and ease into it.
That's such good advice. And I mm-hmm. think I like your the way you see the problem as well, that, hey, I have a dog with this issue mm-hmm. and it's helped me learn this, you know, dog behavior in a mm-hmm. sense. So
yeah.
I think that's a really great way to look at it. And I know we were talking before the call and you mentioned up in Chico. For anyone who isn't familiar with Chico, it's Northern California, and there's definitely been some fires over the mm-hmm. last few years.
Yeah.
Have you or anyone you know had to like experience foster or rescue evacuations? Mm-hmm. And what does that look like when you have a handful of dogs? What happens there?
It's a little bit of a crisis. There is an organization here. I believe they're called the North Valley Animal Disaster Group or something along those lines, where they, if there's a huge catastrophe, they help. So they'll help with farm animals, you know, livestock, dogs, cats. When the Paradise Fire happened, the campfire, the Chico Airport, which is a very small airport, not like a major airport, became the place where people brought animals that they found, or if they had their own animals that they could no longer care for because their house burned down, they brought them there. And there were hundreds of volunteers that were, you know, walking the dogs, feeding the dogs, seeing if they were microchipped, just everything they could do to see if this dog belonged to somebody, or if it did belong to somebody, it needed a place to go to figure that out. A lot of people, I think, stepped up and fostered dogs during that time. I did a lot of volunteer work, but I was full. So I couldn't actually take any dogs from the campfire. But I think a lot of organizations from other places, not necessarily Chico, stepped up and helped. I know that shelters in Sacramento helped, and kind of all over California, and I probably other states too. But yeah, there were a lot of dogs. There were hundreds of dogs that we didn't know where, you know, who owned them or where they belong. So
that's so crazy. So the Chico Airport was like the hub mm-hmm. of all of these animals coming in.
Yeah.
Wow. And that kind of leads me into my next question I was going to ask you is, from I feel like every geographical location poses its own issues in rescue mm-hmm. and fostering. And what are you seeing where you're at, you know, Northern California? What are some of the biggest issues that you're witnessing right now in rescue and fostering?
So specifically Northern California, we have a lot of really small rural shelters that don't have, you know, they have like 10 kennels or zero volunteers or something like that. So it's not like a huge shelter where they can take as many dogs as needed. It's shelters that have 5 to 10 spaces. And when those spaces are filled, that's when they start euthanizing because they don't have room and more dogs are always coming in. So in my area specifically, I would say that that's the biggest issue. We also have a lot of interesting people in this area that breed their dogs that are, you know, mixed dogs or don't spay and neuter. And we have a lot of litters of puppies being posted online. People, you know, backyard breeders trying to sell dogs here. It's definitely not as big of an issue here as it is in more populated areas like LA. I've started rescuing dogs from the LA area just because I've never seen so many dogs in shelters before. So I'm like, I will continue to help in my area, but if I see a dog that I want to help down there, I get them transported up here as well. So different issues in different parts of California, definitely. But up here, I'd say not enough resources.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think that it will ever get solved? Like these issues of whether it be lack of education or mm-hmm. just highly populated areas, just, you know, fostering just a abundant of cats and dogs. Do you think that's ever going to get solved?
I hope so. The only way it is to educate the communities. People often blame the shelters. They're like, oh, this is a horrible shelter. It's a high kill shelter. They kill a ton of dogs here. Well, you have to look at how the dogs got there. The shelter isn't producing dogs. So they got there because they had a bad owner, or people didn't spay or neuter their animals and gave away the puppies, and, you know, they end up in the shelter. For me, the only way it's going to get solved is if there's mandatory spay and neuter laws. People tend to freak out when you say that, but it's not like we're going to spay and neuter every single dog that exists and then dogs are going to go extinct. That's people's argument when you say mandatory spay and neuter. That would never happen. Never, ever. It's impossible for dogs to go extinct. We need stricter laws. We need people that have animals as pets to be required to spay or neuter them. A problem stemming from that is if people can't afford it. So I would say we need government assistance for spay and neuter. We need to make it free for people who have certain household incomes. It needs to be mandatory, though, because the problem is all of these accidental litters or backyard breeders. It's not like breeders are going to not exist if we have mandatory spay and neuter laws. They will just have to jump through a few hoops and prove that they're a reputable breeder that does health testing, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's just, we need to make it illegal for people to breed dogs without any regulations.
I couldn't agree more. I think like you said, it's easy. Everybody always wants a scapegoat, and it's easy to pin it on a rescue. Oh, mm-hmm. You know, this is, they killed so many this month. But like you said, look beyond that. Where are these mm-hmm. dogs coming from? Mm-hmm. Let's dig a little deeper. So yeah, really like your take on that. And what's your, what are your plans going? You've been doing this for a little while now. Mm-hmm. You're operating, in a tight system. And mm-hmm. I like that. What are your goals for the next year or 2 years?
So I definitely want to be able to rescue more dogs. I don't ever want to be a huge rescue because I feel like you lose control. I want each of my dogs to get the best care possible, and I want to know all of them. That way I can match them with the perfect home. So I don't want to get humongous. I do want to have more foster homes available for if I want to pull more dogs from shelters. But my plan, I don't know about the next 2 years, but my long-term goal is to get like a boarding facility where people can, like a doggy daycare / if they go on vacation, I can board their dogs there. That's a really great way to make money. Cause doing dog rescue, you don't make any, it's not something you get into to make money. You end up spending a lot of your own money if you don't have donations. So I've been thinking of how can I make money doing something involving dogs where I could also rescue. So I think a boarding facility is a really great way to do that because I'll have the kennel space so I can still rescue dogs and keep them on my property, but I can also make money boarding other people's dogs or doing doggy daycare or anything like that. So eventually that's what I want to do. That involves buying a property. So it's definitely in the future. But probably not the next 1 or 2 years.
Oh, that's cool. And I think, mm-hmm. I think everyone in the rescue community is faced with that problem of, and it's how do we make money? How do mm-hmm. we make money? Because you have to make money to sustain, to be able to help keeping these dogs. It's, right. it's not cheap sometimes. So mm-hmm. I think that's awesome. And where can people find you, follow you, you know, reach out to you for help and follow your journey?
I have an Instagram that I'm on daily, and it's just Oliver's Dog Rescue. No, you know, punctuations or anything like that, just Oliver's Dog Rescue. On Facebook, it's called Oliver's Safe Haven Dog Rescue. And I'm on those both every day. I respond to messages right away. I will let people know if I can help, or if I can't help, I'll point them in another direction. but those are my two main social media platforms that I use. And that's the best way to get a hold of me for rescue related stuff.
Nice. And I will put those in the description of the link, in the link below. Okay. Wherever you're listening at, you guys can grab that. But Lindsay, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story, what you're doing. Really like what you're doing up there in Chico, and really pumped to follow you along in your journey.
Thank you.